On Doc
and this mess stinking.
When we ain't chilling up in the bricks in the chalet, we chilling out here in Montreal
on CKUT.
Nobody do it better, dog.
90.3 FM.
Gone.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is
there is this thing? Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show, a part of CKUT's Off the Hour. Prison Radio has been on the air for more than 10 years. Prison Radio seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggle by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging our ideas about what are prisons and the people inside our jails. Prison Radio is dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. This is in the interest of forging stronger ties with incarcerated and non-incarcerated people, ensuring that prisoners have direct control over their representation and that our understanding of prisons be informed by those who live inside their walls. We invite anyone who is interested in collaborating on programming to contact us. Those who have been affected by the prison system in any way are encouraged to get involved. You can email news@cqt.ca or prison@cqt.ca, or you can call us at 514-448-4041, extension 6788. You are listening to CQUT, Montreal Community Campus Radio, located on 90.3 FM on the dial and www.cqut.ca online.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Noah.
And my name is Candace.
And we're your hosts for today's show. Today we'll be hearing an interview with Walida M. Marisha, one of the editors of the new book Octavia's Brood, a book of visionary fiction stories inspired by social movements. We talked to Walida about the power of visionary fiction, prison abolition, and imagining worlds without prisons. We'll also be hearing part of a panel discussion on Native women in the prison industrial complex. Danielle Lennon will speak about the connections between residential schools and the over-incarceration of Aboriginal women. But first, we wanted to share with you two calls for support, one for political prisoner Robert Seth Hayes in the U.S., who is being denied critical medical care, and one is for queer prisoners at the Grand Valley Institute for Women in Ontario, who are facing repression due to their choices of romantic partners. Both the calls for support include phone numbers to call. We will repost all of the information on our blog, prisonradioshow.wordpress.com.
We recently received this distressing information about the ongoing persecution of Comrade Robert Seth Hayes. Seth has had a chronic cough since May of this year, for which he did not receive any diagnosis or treatment for many months. When Seth finally saw the pulmonologist at Coxsackie on Monday, November 2nd, the doctor wanted to know why the medical personnel at Sullivan, the prison where he's being held, had waited so long to bring Seth for a pulmonary exam. The doctors intend to schedule for Seth a CT scan of his heart and blood work. The pulmonologist thought there might be some infection, but needs more information. In addition, the facility doctor told Seth to come to the clinic to use the nebulizer whenever he feels short of breath. Seth has been using an inhaler twice a day. Seth does not get to carry his inhaler, so needs to go to medical when he gets short of breath, and also the nebulizer twice a day for a while now, although he does not yet have a diagnosis of the cause of his chronic cough. On a prior occasion, about 10 days ago, C.O. Slater, who was accompanying Seth to the clinic, stated that Seth did not really need the nebulizer. Then the nurses did not attend to Seth, and he had to overcome his difficulty breathing on his own. On November 9th, the same thing happened again, with C.O. Slater once again claiming that Seth did not really need the nebulizer. Seth passed out shortly thereafter, and a code blue was called on him. We need people to call Superintendent Kaiser at Sullivan, specifically about C.O. Slater interfering with and preventing Seth from receiving needed medical attention. This C.O. should never accompany Seth to the medical clinic again. Also ask why the nurses are not following the facility doctor's medical advice instead of paying attention to C.O. Slater. We also need people to call and fax Dr. Nancy Ling in Albany to demand that Seth receive all needed pulmonary tests as soon as possible and that C.O. Slater be prohibited from accompanying Seth to the clinic in the future. This is attempted medical murder of one of our beloved freedom fighters, and we must do everything possible to help Seth at this time. And so here are the numbers to call. There is Superintendent Kaiser at Sullivan, 845-434-2080. Dr. Konigsman, 518-457-7073. And fax, 518-445-7553. There's Nancy Ling at 518-445-6176. Seth needs visitors and letters. You can write to him at Robert Seth Hayes, number 74A, 2280, Sullivan Correctional Facility, P.O. Box 116, Fallsburg, New York, 12733-0116.
At Grand Valley Institute for Women, GVI for short, a federal prison in Kitchener, Ontario, there's been recent crackdown against LGBTQ2+ prisoners and or prisoners in relationships amongst themselves. Intimate relationships between prisoners are being attacked by a clique of guards acting without apparent direction or oversight from the Corrections Canada Administration. We need your support with a call-in campaign to end these practices. Harassment of prisoners includes throwing them in solitary as punishment for being in a relationship, threatening them with transfers to remote parts of the country, separating partners by placing them in different parts of the prison, and laying spurious institutional charges that can lead to being locked in the maximum security unit. Most troublingly, guards have been using physical intimidation and invasions of personal space to harass prisoners who speak up against these practices. In violation of their own rules, individual guards have been entering prisoners' cells at night with an institutional history of sexual violence and exploitation of prisoners by guards at GVI. This can only be understood as a threat. All of this is happening due to a growing culture of impunity among the guards, created by a power vacuum at higher levels. GVI currently has no warden overseeing the actions of the guards and doesn't expect to hire one for another year. The federal corrections investigator, who handles oversight and prisoner grievances, didn't have his contract renewed by the federal government, leaving no one to respond to grievance reports filed by prisoners. Compounding all this, the recent elections have left the government without a sitting Minister of Public Safety, and the prisoners are left without the flimsy accountability that may offer. GVI has still not made any of the necessary changes with respect to the Ashley Smith inquiry, which drew national attention as the prison was investigated by a coroner's inquest into a prisoner's death in segregation. The prisoners have been organizing in response to these attacks, but have faced increasing repression for their efforts. Their attempts to start an official two-spirited group were turned down, and there has been little ability to meet or congregate without official consent. By contrast, an application for an association of white prisoners made by white supremacist inmates was approved immediately. Outside support right now can make a major difference in putting a check on the repression of prisoner relationships and dissent among prisoners. What can you do? Call Grand Valley Institute for Women at 519-894-2011. Ask for the acting warden. Even if you're not able to speak with the warden, the person on the line can take a message for you. It's important to get these questions and demands into the prison. so be confident and firm. Tell them criminalizing sexuality and denying prisoners in segregation their rights needs to stop now. Ask them to address some of these questions or check out the website gviwatch.wordpress.com for a prepared statement you can read. Some examples of questions you can ask are, why are you criminalizing inmate sexuality? Which of the commissioner directives, policies from CSC, states that physical intimacy is illegal? Spoiler alert, the answer is none of them. Why are you denying people in segregation access to their lawyer? Why is there currently no meaningful way for inmates to file grievances about abuses of power by guards? If asking questions seems too hard, there's also a whole statement up on GVI Watch's website that you can check out and read to the acting warden. Their website is gviwatch.wordpress.com.
We also want to remind our listeners that Mumia Abu-Jamal is also facing denial of medical care. You can find out more about his case and how you can support him at prisonradio.org. Here is his most recent essay from that same site.
Whoever we are, no matter our media source, we need not go far to find a praise story in the press about police. A cop pulls a man from a burning car. A cop helps an old lady across the street. These are staples upon which the media machine feeds. Yet when the Associated Press Media Wire Service released its recent exclusive on police across the country engaging in hundreds of acts of sexual oppression, rape, sodomy, and targeted sexual molestation of children, the silence has been deafening. Almost 1,000 cops, from sheriff deputies to so-called school resource officers, raping, sodomizing, forcing women, children, and men into sexually compromised positions is, to say the least, deeply shocking. The article, which filled a whole page of the Sunday Times of Scranton, Pennsylvania, featured a chilling account of a woman in her 50s returning home from a game of dominoes with friends. Suddenly, a police car signaled her to stop, and she did so. For the cop's safety, she was pat-searched. Then her blouse was pulled up, and her pants were pulled down. Another search. Clearly unarmed, the woman was forced to give the cop oral sex in the patrol car of the Oklahoma City Police Department. The cop barked out, "Come on, I don't have all night." The AP researched hundreds of cases such as these from all over the country, covering some 44 states. Journalist Matt Sedensky and Noman Marchant found cases covering children in school suffering molestation from so-called school resource officers, to teenaged members of police internship programs chased, harassed, and raped by their adult police trainers. As shocking as it is repellent, this is a story of police gone wild, where they serve and protect themselves and treat those who pay them as so much rubbish. If you haven't read this in your local paper, or heard it on radio, or seen it covered in the news of your local or national news programs, you have been woefully misinformed about the true nature of American police. This ain't law and order. These are the actions of outlaws and disorder masquerading as peace officers. This is America's rape culture, silent, hidden violence against the weak, the unarmed, the young, and the helpless. This is America at the beginning of a new century in the grip of police madness. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Danielle Linen practices Aboriginal law with the Dion Schultz Law Firm. She has also been involved in specific claims files before the Specific Claims Tribunal, representing former residential school students from many communities in Quebec. She spoke at a September panel organized by the 2110 Center for Gender Advocacy and Radlaw McGill, titled Native Women in the Prison Industrial Complex. Danielle Linen correlates the Indian residential schooling system with the over-incarceration of Indigenous women in Quebec.
As most of you undoubtedly know, the over-incarceration of Aboriginal women has been steadily on the rise for many years now. Aboriginal women make up more than 35% of the prison population, even though they only make up around 4% of the Canadian population. So that's a very jarring statistic. There are a myriad of complex reasons for why this is happening, and most of them are rooted in systemic racism. That may include, for instance, racial profiling by police officers of Aboriginal people off-reserve, and paradoxically, the lack of supervision by police officers of Aboriginal communities on-reserve. For myself, I'd like to focus tonight's discussion on how the judicial system has failed to take into account the historical legacy and contemporary impacts of Indian residential schools. So I've been representing Indian residential school survivors for the last 3 years now, and I've seen firsthand the links between these schools and the over-incarceration of women in prisons. I'm going to assume that most of you know what Indian residential schools are, but just very briefly, they started in the 1800s, and does anyone know when the last one closed? 1996, very good. So you have seven generations of people that went to Indian residential schools. Clearly, it was a policy of assimilation, so we're trying to take the Indian out of the child. And that colonialist policy, it amounted to cultural genocide. And I find it's best illustrated in this awful quote by Sir John A. Macdonald in 1883. So he said, "When the school is on the reserve, the child lives with his parents, who are savages. He is surrounded by savages, and though he may learn to read and write, his habits and training and mode of thought are Indian. Children should be withdrawn as much as possible from parental influence." So life on residential schools clearly was very lonely and unfamiliar. Children were subject to neglect and emotional abuse. They ate very little, and from what I've heard, what they did get to eat was really disgusting and of poor quality. They were severed from their culture, be it if they spoke their language, and discipline was extremely harsh, leaving children sometimes permanently disabled or starved. I put Mohawk Institute here because many Aboriginal people from Quebec went to this particular residential school, and it's one of the residential schools that was open for the longest time. It's actually in Ontario, but they were sent there, and it actually had punishment chambers and torture chambers, so you can see from one of the testimonials from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that students there felt like it was a prison, and that you were treated as though you were a criminal. So as you know, physical and sexual abuse are one of the uglier sides of Indian residential schools. And some children who were abused ended up abusing others, because violence does indeed breed violence, which is why the legacy of residential school doesn't only affect the people that attended these schools, but it also affects family members, so spouses and children, and that's still a very contemporary issue. Many students who went to these schools developed addictions as means of coping and numbing out pain. And a lot of students, like I said, were treated like prisoners, and often there was a very short time frame between going from residential school to prison, as I find is well illustrated by this quote by Mervyn Morasty, who again testified at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and he was sexually abused at the Beauville Indian Residential School. So he says, "I ran away from school, I'd go out, I'd walk around town, I'd steal whatever I could steal, I started stealing cars. I got caught at 15, I ended up in jail. From that point of 15 years till the year 2000, I got sentenced to 25 years altogether. I drank, I stole, I hardly worked. I used the system, the welfare system, and plus I stole and I drank." And this story is sadly not uncommon. But there are a lot of positive cases of resilience and people that managed to heal. But yeah, I've heard the story time and time again. So how did Canada deal with the legacy of Indian residential schools? They dealt with it through a settlement agreement whereby survivors received a common experience payment. So that's monetary compensation for the years that they went to the schools. And for those who had physical or sexual abuse claims, they are adjudicated in what's called the independent assessment process. And that's where I work. That's what I do when I represent survivors. So in that process, Canada hears the stories, and they have to establish a causal link between abuses and psychological harm suffered and opportunity loss. Okay? So, you know, you have loss of self-esteem, retaliatory rage, guilt, anxiety, and it escalates to post-traumatic stress disorder, suicidal tendencies, eating disorder, sexual dysfunction, psychotic disorganization, loss of ego boundaries. There are so many, right? And the reason that's important is by compensating victims and by stating, yes, you know, you fall into this category, you have these psychological harms that came out of the schools, Canada is acknowledging responsibility for its structural violence towards Indian residential school survivors and the psychological ravages of its colonialist policies. I would say that the ensuing violence and trauma of Indian residential schools has in many ways been worse on women and men than men, and let me explain why. There are gender conditions that are specific to Aboriginal women that came out of the IRS. For instance, in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and you know, I've heard again this many, many times, a lot of men have regretfully admitted to domestic violence on their spouses or female community members, and a lot of times this was during a period where they were intoxicated, and the data shows this. So for instance, Aboriginal women are 3.5 times more likely to be victims of domestic violence than non-Aboriginal women, and they're 5 times more likely to be victims of homicide than Aboriginal women. So they live in particularly endangered conditions. So Aboriginal women are subject to what I call compound discrimination. So they're discriminated against for being Aboriginal and also for being women, because for all the ladies out here, we have not reached gender equality just yet in Canada, but we've made tremendous progress. And in addition, they have been subject to compound forms of violence. So not only have they endured emotional and physical and sexual abuse at residential school, intergenerational trauma if their parents or their grandparents went to residential schools, but also too often they're also victims of domestic abuse from people who also attended residential school. So by now, I'm hoping that you have figured out the link between over-incarceration of Aboriginal women in residential schools, the disproportionate imprisonment and victimization of Aboriginal women can be explained in large part as a result of the legacy of the way that Aboriginal children were treated in schools and the fact that they were denied a safe growing environment. Now, this is important because of sentencing judges. Sentencing judges are basically when you're convicted of a crime or you plead guilty or you're found guilty, then you go in front of a sentencing judge and he determines what your sentence is going to be. Is it going to be community work, or are you going to go to jail, or are you going to be sent to your community to as a conditional sentence? And it appears that they're failing to take into account the specific history and the gender conditions of Aboriginal women. And so we end up in this pattern of victimization and criminalization. And then once the criminalization is set in motion, Aboriginal women are often victimized again in prison, where discrimination is rampant there as well. So I'm explaining all of this to you with nice pie charts and government grids and arrows, and I'm trying to use academic language because we're in MOOC court and why not. But what really drives this home for me is thinking about You know, I think about the adversity that I faced, and it pales in comparison to what a lot of these people have faced. And yet it's had, you know, effects on my life, on my sense of self-worth, on my self-esteem, my identity. And I imagine that many of you have gone, you know, through really bad breakups. Perhaps you were assaulted by someone that you trusted. Maybe you're going through a divorce. Maybe you come from a poor single-parent household, or maybe someone close to you has died of an accident, a disease, or suicide. You know, maybe you got a D on your term paper and you're really upset about that, and that would be legitimate as well. But, you know, if you think of the effects that that's had on you in your life, and you think that we have recourse to counseling, to psychologists, to psychiatrists, to medication, and then you compare that to what a lot of these people have gone through, I mean, it really does put things in perspective. And I can say quite humbly for myself that I wouldn't be here today in front of you if I had gone through even, you know, half of what a lot of my clients have gone through. And I certainly could have ended up in juvenile detention or have committed certain infractions or crimes. And so I find that the Supreme Court actually sums that up really well in this one phrase, which is, few mortals could withstand such a childhood and youth without becoming seriously troubled. So what has the judicial system done about this? Canada was alerted of the crisis of over-incarceration of Aboriginal people over 2 decades ago. They knew 2 decades ago that there were too many Aboriginal people in prison, and yet that's just that those numbers have increased since then. So Parliament and the Supreme Court have recognized that the legacy of residential schools should be considered when sentencing Aboriginals. Bear in mind that criminal law is premised on the basis that criminal liability follows from voluntary conduct. I hope that I've convinced you that the level of violence and discrimination against Aboriginal people, especially women, attains a level where one could properly say that their actions are not voluntary and therefore not deserving of the same criminal sanctions. So in other words, it's almost like their circumstances diminish their moral culpability. So it was for that reason that in 1996, the criminal code was amended in order to add this section on sentencing, which basically says to judges, you need to take into consideration the special circumstances of Aboriginal people. In 1999, there was a landmark Supreme Court decision called R.v. Gladue, and the court concluded in that decision that crime is a result of systemic and direct discrimination as attested to by residential schools. They also recognized that Aboriginal offenders are more adversely affected by incarceration and less likely to be rehabilitated in jails and prisons because imprisonment is often culturally inappropriate and it furthers discrimination against the Aboriginal offenders. So the big question is what do judges do with that? So basically the way it works tangibly is they get presented with what we call Gladue reports, okay? And in these reports, they have all the background information, socioeconomic information on the Aboriginal offender, and they're supposed to really take that into consideration when they sentence them. So they look at some of these, poverty and unemployment rates, which is basically systemic discrimination, including in residential school trauma. And then they're supposed to have softer sentencing. So it seems very strange that this was in 96, and yet in 2015, this problem is a lot worse than it was back then. So what went wrong? And it seems like there are multiple answers to that question, but some of them are that it's been shown that judges don't implement Gladue principle in a consistent manner. It's also been shown that there's underfunding of Aboriginal restorative justice programs. So, for instance, you can't expect a judge to send and offender to an Aboriginal healing lodge if it's overcrowded or underfunded or if it simply doesn't exist yet, right? The Harper government has also passed an omnibus crime bill where mandatory minimum sentences restrict judicial discretion for judges to have Aboriginal offenders serve sentences in communities. So, for instance, if you're charged with, robbery or having cocaine possession or something like that, there might be a mandatory minimum sentence where the judge has no choice and has to send you to prison. But I find that the most shocking reason for this, as a lawyer anyway, is the fact that some judges seem to be using blind reports to justify the incarceration of Aboriginal offenders. So basically what this means is they're using the background information on, let's say, female offenders, and including the gender conditions, they'll look at domestic violence and things like that. And instead of applying what the court said, they say to themselves, well, you know, look, this person has alcohol problems and they suffer from depression and they're unemployed. And even though all that stems from residential schools, well, this person needs treatment and they pose a greater risk to society. They have a higher risk of reoffending. There's no realistic prospect for them for rehabilitation, and therefore they should be incarcerated. And that is the antithesis of the principles in GLADU. Other judges are not, they actually do it in an indirect way where they say, okay, we'll apply GLADU, but you have to prove it. So you're an Aboriginal offender, and so prove to me that the harms caused by, let's say, Indian residential schools led you to commit this crime. It's practically impossible for an Aboriginal offender to establish a direct causal link between their circumstances and the offending. Those interconnections are far, far too complex. There is hope, though, because the Supreme Court in 2012, in the decision RV Ippoli, basically reiterated what it said in GLADU, and it was a big, like, you know, I don't want to say fuck you, but kind of, to judges out there saying, hey, what we said in GLADU, we actually meant it, and you better start applying it. So, and they specifically said, you cannot ask Aboriginal offenders to draw direct correlation between, you know, the Canadian government's treatment and their crime. That's ridiculous. And you have to impose Section 718 of the Criminal Code and consider the unique circumstances of Aboriginal offenders. And if you fail to do this, you're violating fundamental principles of sentencing. Because sentences at the basis of it, they have to be proportionate to the gravity of the offense and the degree of responsibility of the offender. And that's the crux. Canada is complicit in the responsibility in this case. So this leads me to my final point, which is from my own personal point of view, my own personal experience. I work with lawyers and adjudicators or judges who are more culturally sensitive than most in the legal community. And still, I see cultural stereotypes that creep up or culturally inappropriate comments. So, for instance, I've seen silence on the part of Aboriginal offenders viewed as a lack of remorse, when in certain Aboriginal cultures, silence is viewed as respect. And I've seen non-Aboriginal people in the legal community have critical views of traditional healing methods, so you could tell that they're dubious of it, and it doesn't, they don't say it directly because they're politically correct, but you sense it. So I'm convinced that's happening in the criminal justice system as well, because we operate in a cultural myopia. We're not aware that we're acting within our own conventional sets of rules. And if you're a judge, you're taught that blame and individual responsibility are the pillars of the criminal justice system. I suspect that judges are preoccupied at deterring harmful activities and that they don't truly embrace the traditional native ways of seeing things, which may, for instance, be anchored in restoring community harmony and forgiveness and rehabilitation. I think that for many people, they're unaware that they think that our way of doing things is the proper way. And I suspect they have trouble seeing that crime is rooted in destructive legacies of colonialization that wreak havoc on many Aboriginal people's lives, especially women. And for me, that is the dark underside of silent stereotypes. They creep up insidiously. Today, we call the Indian residential school experience cultural genocide. And I wonder if in a few decades from now, we will not call the incarceration of Aboriginal women, who are also mothers, whose children may be taken away and put into non-Aboriginal families, also a form of cultural genocide. Last Saturday, I was with my friend and his mother, and I'm confident enough with you guys to actually tell you that I hang out with my friend's mother. And she said, "You can't love what you don't know." And I think there's a lot of truth to that. We have lived in isolation from Aboriginal people for far too long, especially here in Quebec. And I think it's time to learn to know each other better and cultivate respect from one another. And that often starts with a conversation, like the conversation we're having right now, and getting informed and then taking action. So I hope that you will contact your local MPs and complain about this. And so I really do thank you all for being here tonight and giving... Honestly, you're giving me hope that, you know, together we can hopefully solve this problem one day. So you have restored my faith in humanity, and I really thank you for that.
That was Danielle Lennon speaking at a September panel on Native women in the prison industrial complex. The panel was organized by the 2110 Center and Rad Law McGill. Danielle Lennon practices Aboriginal law. She spoke about how the judicial system fails to take into account the impact of residential schools in the sentencing of Indigenous women in Quebec.
Up next, an interview with Walida Emerisha.
So my name is Walida Emerisha, and I am a writer, a poet, a public scholar, and one of the co-editors of Octavia's Brood, Science Fiction Stories from Social Justice Movements.
The book that you're here in Montreal to talk about is Octavia's Brood. And you wrote an article called Imagine a World Without Prisons, Science Fiction, Fantasy, Superheroes, and Prison Abolition that was published in The Abolitionist in December 2013. And you said that you and Adrienne Marie Brown, who's your co-editor with the book, you said you two, quote, found justice, incarceration, and community accountability to be strong themes in many of the stories written for Octavia's Brood. Can you talk a bit about the stories that deal with those themes and a bit about how they deal with them?
Sure. I mean, I think that that concept of justice is something that folks keep exploring again and again. And I think one of the reasons is that we are so kind of inundated with, since we get here, with the idea that the only thing that constitutes justice is police and the criminal legal system and prisons, that stepping into science fiction is one of the only realms where we can actually begin to conceptualize our own idea of what justice is. And so we definitely saw that being something that happened a lot through Octavia's Brood, either something that directly talked about that, like Kalanu Yasalam's story, Manhunters, and it's set in a Afrocentric, futuristic society that's matriarchal, and it takes place, one of the women warriors, all of the warriors are actually women, killed another warrior, and so the community has come together to try and figure out how to heal the harm that's been done outside of the context of prisons within this kind of futuristic but also ancient knowledge framework of Afro past, Afrofuturism.
Mm-hmm. In one of the other articles that you wrote, I can't remember which one it is now, you talk a lot about connecting with past struggles as like a way to project like hope into the future for struggles in the future. And I mean, you're kind of bringing that up again in this story. Do you want to talk a bit more about that and how those ideas affect the organizing and the writing that you do?
I think that there's been a lot of work happening historically, but also currently around the kind of challenging linear notions of time within the context of kind of revolutionary folks of color, revolutionary blackness specifically. So Rashida Phillips with the Afrofuturist Affair and Metropolarity in Philadelphia edited an anthology called Black Quantum Futurism, and really talks about the ways that and goes into in specific different African societies historically, like the Dogon or the Igbo or whatever, that the notions of time were completely different, that it was not linear, that it was actually cyclical, that it wasn't, time was never constant. As we're told, it's a constant, time is a myth, that time actually could only be understood kind of looking backwards, so that the future actually shaped the past, which we're told is an impossibility, right? But all of these are actually things that now quantum physicists are like, oh, by the way, you guys, meanwhile, cultures of color are like, right, we've been telling you that forever. But I think it's a really important framework, because I think that the idea of linear time, of absolute time, is one of the greatest methods of social control. The idea that the past is gone, it's something you can't access anymore, the future is unknown, unseeable, you can't know it or hope to know it, all you have is the present, so you might as well get whatever little tidbit of comfort you can get in the present. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely social control, and capitalism is based on the notion of linear, absolute time, right? You can't pay someone a wage for their labor if it's not, set up in that way. So I think, and I think specifically talking about prisons, I mean, the concept of doing time, right, and the ways that these systems of oppression steal time away. I think it's really important for us to recognize that we are actually, always time traveling, that the future is impacting us, that we're impacting the past, that we can reach backwards and forwards, and actually that we live in all of those realities at once. I think especially for oppressed peoples, that's something that's really true, that we are actually, we are the culmination of someone else's dream, and we're the walking embodiment of that. And meanwhile, we're dreaming the future into existence as well. So I think that recognizing that we exist in all of those places, I hope allows us to transcend some of these mechanisms of control.
In the vein of shouting out other books that have influenced you, in one of the articles that I was reading, I think it's the one from The Abolitionist, you were writing about how many organizers cite books like Women on the Edge of Time, or Dahlgren, or Midnight Robber, or Futureland, The Dispossessed, Fifth Sacred Thing, Who Fears Death, and Lilith's Brood as important texts to study for anyone thinking about building alternatives to incarceration. I was wondering if you could talk more about reading science fiction or speculative fiction as a way of strategizing a radically different understanding of how to deal with harm in our communities.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we absolutely need something like science fiction, because science fiction is the only genre that not only allows us to throw away everything that we think is real and realistic and possible, but it actually demands that, right? We can't hold on to what's possible if we're also dealing with like squid people from Mars, right? Like, we got to choose which do we want to hold on to. And so I think, I think that the concept of, alternatives to incarceration and ways to keep communities safe and whole and address harm without relying on carceral ideas is, in this society, it's viewed as science fiction, right? I feel like every time I talk about prison abolition, folks are like, oh, did you bring a unicorn too, right? And so I think it's a really powerful space for us to be able to enter into. I know that, the first time that I was able to see a society that was dealing with abolition was in high school when I read Marge Piercy's Woman on the Edge of Time. And they had this society where they addressed harm, and it blew my mind because I was like, oh my God, not only is this some kind of vague idea that something's wrong, something's not right. Here's this book that's like, here's exactly what's wrong. And also, there are so many other possibilities. And I think that's the thing that's so powerful about science fiction is that when it's used in liberatory movements, it shows us that possibilities are infinite, that we're actually only limited by our imagination.
So you have another book coming out.
Yes.
When is it coming out?
February.
Okay. And this is nonfiction.
Yes.
About stories about the criminal justice system and sort of about different characters who are dealing with different things related to the criminal justice system. Do you want to talk a bit about that book and sort of what led you to writing it?
Sure. It's called Angels with Dirty Faces, Three Stories of Crime, Prison, and Redemption. It's actually something I've been working on for over a decade of my life. So I'm time traveling every time I think about that project. And it's a creative nonfiction book about prisons that looks at the lives of three people, myself, my adopted brother, who is incarcerated, and then Jimmy Mack, who was a Irish gangster who was incarcerated with my brother until he passed away. And for me, I mean, it's the same concepts in the real world. And for me, it was really an attempt to ask questions. I don't put forward clear answers. I'm not saying, okay, well, here's the prescription for how we, you know, abolish prisons and address serious harm that's done. But instead, the point of the book was to say, you know, sometimes human beings do horrific things to one another. And then what, right? And then how do we address that while still maintaining our humanity? Because I think that prisons not only are fundamentally inhuman, but they actually make all of us less human. And so for me, the idea was to try and humanize folks who are shown as monsters in the mainstream, and also begin to ask questions and say, if we allow everyone to be human, to be sometimes horrifically flawed, but still human, where does that lead us?
I want to ask a little about like prisoner justice organizing stuff that you've done. I was reading on your website that you were involved in a group called HRC, mm-hmm. And the Human Rights Coalition, and founding it in Pennsylvania. Do you want to talk a bit about that experience? And are you still involved in that kind of organizing these days?
Yeah, so I was one of the folks who helped to found the Human Rights Coalition. It was actually the brainchild of political prisoner Russell Maroon Choates, who's a former Black Liberation Army member. And the idea was that, you know, oftentimes in organizing around, you know, prison justice, it kind of falls into two camps. There's sort of the radical action-oriented organizations that are often led not by folks who are directly affected, who often kind of, you know, at their worst use ex-prisoners and prisoners' families as window dressing. And then I think that what we were finding was that a lot of the spaces for that were led by prisoners' families were more support places, which is absolutely necessary. But we felt like there needed to be an organization that was actively organizing, doing community organizing, that was led by prisoners, former prisoners, and prisoners' families. And so that was the idea behind the Human Rights Coalition. And so it spread and became three chapters, which is very exciting. But I don't live in Philadelphia anymore. I live in Portland, Oregon. And so most of the work that I've been doing there is trying to connect police violence with kind of conversations around prisons, to see that I think that oftentimes the criminal legal system is separated out. And in fact, in, you know, the kind of mainstream conversations about, okay, well, police are killing, you know, unarmed people of color, especially Black folks, you know, every day or every other day, what is the solution? Lock the cops up, right? And we're like, that's A, never happens, and B, doesn't actually address the concerns, and in fact, makes communities of color less safe if we're strengthening the prison industrial complex. So how can we actually envision dealing with violence within our community and also the horrific violent assaults on our communities without relying on those same structures to protect us?
So in the same article from The Abolitionist, I'm drawing a lot from it because you said a lot of awesome things. You said, prison abolition says we know inherently we have the ability to be the best of ourselves. Abolition says we can operate from the principles of wholeness and healing rather than retribution and vengeance. And you talk about how the struggle is ongoing, and you talk about this like sci-fi quest analogy with like a political struggle. Do you have any thoughts for people who are just getting involved in this kind of thinking, who are just getting involved in this kind of organizing? Like, were there things that inspired you to come into these viewpoints for yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I definitely had a critique of the prison system for a very long time. But I think really moving to a place of saying, what do we want, right? And I think that is often a scarier place, because then the responsibility is on us. It's not on the system to change or stop being really messed up. It's on us to say, all right, well, what do we want? And then how do we begin to build that into existence? And so, I mean, I think that there are many ways to do this. I think that people often get very overwhelmed by the idea of prison abolition, because prison is a system that touches every single moment of our lives, right? That the idea behind prisons, the carceral framework, is something that shapes everything. And so you could be like, well, yikes, I don't know where to begin. But I also think the great thing about abolition, and one of the Octavia's Brood contributors, Alexis Pauline Gunz, has written a lot of amazing stuff around abolition. And she wrote this this one essay called Freedom Seeds that was in the Critical Resistance collection Abolition Now, where she says, what if abolition is not a taking away? What if abolition is not a negative or an empty space? What if abolition is a growing thing? What if abolition is something that is, you know, is wet and smells of earth and is cultivated and wild and grows? And I think that that's such a beautiful idea to say, we want to start growing something. And it also, like, growing starts with a seed, right? You take a seed, you put it in the ground, you cover it up, you water it, right? Like, it's a simple act that everyone can do, but it's through that cultivation that that something much larger comes into being. And so, you know, I think that there are a lot of amazing resources that Critical Resistance has, where it's kind of like, how can we begin abolition on an everyday basis? How do we begin to just engage with other human beings differently, so we're not stuck in this carceral framework, where we can actually see one another as humans, so when issues arise, we can actually engage with folks as humans rather than as threats or predators.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Walida Imarisha, one of the editors of the new book, Octavia's Brood, which gathered visionary fiction stories from social justice organizers and writers. We caught up with Walida at her keynote talk for Kubrick McGill's Culture Shock series this past weekend. We talked to her about prison abolition, the power of visionary fiction, and time traveling.
We are getting close to the end of our show. Thanks for tuning in. Here is a song for women in prison recorded at the Native Women in Prison panel.
Yeah. The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated.
With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison by calling 438-858-6116. Thank you to the folks at Fed Phone Line for gifting us this number. Again, the number is 438-858-6116. Feel free to call us from inside with news, song requests, and shoutouts. Pass the number along to family and friends on the outside who are also welcome to call.
Consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had. Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number. You weren't a man. You want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
The law. When they hang my husband...
We'll be right back. afternoon. You're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing your wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked into CKT 90.3 FM.